Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we really try to unlock that cutting-edge knowledge for better mental and physical health, you know, performance too. Today, we are plunging headfirst into, well, frankly, the fascinating and, let's face it, increasingly popular world of peptides and hormone therapies. This is an area that's clearly making some pretty significant waves in personalized health, offering incredible new avenues, really, for optimizing our well-being. And to guide us through this pretty intricate landscape, we have a true world expert in what he calls performance medicine. That's a field dedicated to using these, well, advanced therapies to augment overall health. So let's unpack this right from the top. For anyone new to this space, fundamentally, what exactly are peptides and just how vast is this world we're stepping into?
Well, fundamentally, peptides are just small proteins. They're chains of amino acids. Our body actually makes a huge number of them. Naturally, we're talking about maybe 300,000 different types.
Wow, 300,000.
Yeah, it's enormous. But therapeutically, you know, in the clinical world, we're really only actively using about 150 or so. It truly is a blossoming field with new discoveries happening all the time. What's fascinating, I think, is where peptides sit on that whole spectrum of health augmentation. You can kind of think of it like this. On one end, you've got just doing nothing, right? Beyond basic diet and exercise.
Right, baseline.
Exactly. Then you step up to general supplementation. Peptides really sit between that and the more, let's say, advanced traditional prescription hormone therapies. And the key distinction really is that peptides can augment specific hormone pathways, specific processes, without typically shutting down your own body's natural production.
Oh, okay.
Which is a pretty significant advantage over just directly manipulating hormones with exogenous sources.
That's a really crucial distinction, isn't it? And probably a big part of why they're getting so much attention. So our mission today for you listening is to provide that cutting-edge knowledge, dive into safety concerns, potential side effects, and, this is critical, the issue of sourcing clean peptides. We'll always, always stress how important it is to work with a board-certified physician. And just as a very recent update, right before we started this deep dive, some peptides like CJC-1295, epimorelin, thymosin beta-alpha, they've actually been reallowed for prescription in the U.S., which just shows how dynamic this whole field is, how it's constantly evolving. Okay, so let's talk about the big one, the compound that seems like it's everywhere right now.
Yeah.
GLP-1 analogs, you know, the stuff behind Ozempic and Mounjaro. Can you walk us through their origin story? How did they become such a, well, phenomenon?
Certainly, yeah. They really took off. These compounds, like semaglutide and tirzepatide, they were initially developed and approved for type 2 diabetes. Their main job was to help patients with glucose control utilization, basically helping the body manage blood sugar more effectively.
Right, for diabetes.
Exactly.
And then came the discovery that really changed everything, didn't it? The thing that's got everyone talking today.
Yeah.
What was that side effect people started noticing?
Precisely. It was observed pretty clearly that patients were experiencing significant weight loss just as a side effect initially. And this led to, well, widespread off-label use for weight management long before the FDA eventually gave specific approval for weight loss itself.
That point about off-label use is really interesting. I bet a lot of listeners might be surprised by just how common that is. Can you elaborate a bit? Why is that practice so widespread, and what does it mean for patients in the bigger medical picture?
Oh, it's fundamental. It really is. The vast majority, and I'm in the vast majority, of medicines prescribed in America are actually prescribed off-label.
Really?
Yes. A physician is legally allowed to prescribe any approved drug for any reason they deem medically safe and appropriate for their patient, even if it wasn't the original approved use. It shows how doctors often innovate, you know, adapt treatments in the real world way beyond the initial scope, and that opens up possibilities for patients that might not otherwise exist, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, when it comes to GLP-1 specifically, there are definitely two camps out there in the public debate. You've got the bullish enthusiasm on one side, people really excited, and then you have concerns, right, about potential drug dependency, the cost, and this idea that lifestyle changes are just inherently superior.
Right, the lifestyle versus drug debate.
Exactly. My philosophy as a clinician, frankly, is to help people win the race first.
Mm.
If I can help someone achieve significant initial weight loss with GLP-1s, they often become incredibly motivated. They want to train for the next race, you know, meaning sustained long-term lifestyle changes.
Ah, so it's a catalyst.
Precisely. I had a client just yesterday. She looked at me and said, "You've changed my life." She said, "Now I love my life. My workouts are better. My clothes fit better. I'm excited about waking up." That aha moment, that shift in mindset, that's what it's really all about.
That's powerful. What about the concern over losing muscle mass along with the fat? That comes up a lot.
Yeah, that's a valid concern. What we've observed is that when people use the conventional higher dosages, they often lose weight too quickly, and that can definitely lead to muscle loss. So what we do is get semaglutide and tirzepatide compounded. That allows us to microdose them, go really slow.
Okay, compounding for lower doses.
Right. And as long as people are losing, say, 2 pounds or less per week, they're typically not losing significant muscle mass. Of course, we strongly encourage adequate protein intake alongside that, and resistance training is key.
Makes sense.
And beyond just the weight loss, we're seeing some surprising cognitive benefits too, and a reduction in inflammation markers. I have a 50-year-old patient, for example, with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Her thyroid peroxidase antibodies, those are markers of the immune attack on the thyroid. They've actually come down. And we believe it's due to the GLP-1. It links that reduction in adipose tissue, body fat, to better brain health and less systemic inflammation.
That connection between fat tissue and brain health is fascinating. Okay, so GLP-1s are tackling weight and inflammation.
Hmm.
Let's pivot to another really popular peptide, BPC-157, often called the body protection compound. Lots of animal data, maybe less human clinical stuff, right? What are its main uses in your practice?
Yeah, BPC-157, we've used it extensively in the clinic. Its primary uses are definitely for treating inflammation and really accelerating wound healing. What's remarkable about it is its unique ability to upregulate growth hormone receptors.
Upregulate them, meaning make them more sensitive.
Exactly. So it pairs very well synergistically with growth hormone releasing peptides and makes them work better. Its mechanism involves initiating fibroblast migration. Oh, you can think of fibroblasts as the body's little repair crews. They rush in.
Okay.
And that aids in rapid tissue repair. Now, in terms of forms, the oral BPC is generally more limited to gut issues, things like IBD, Crohn's, leaky gut syndrome.
Right, localized to the gut.
Correct.
Yeah.
But the injectable BPC, given subcutaneously just under the skin, surprisingly works systemically, even for injuries far away from the injection site.
Really? Systemically from a local shot?
Yeah. And it's remarkably pain-free for an injection, like less than a Texas mosquito bite, honestly.
Okay. But this brings up a really critical question, doesn't it? The risk of getting peptides from gray market or even dark gray market sources. Can you explain what those terms mean and why it's such a concern?
Absolutely critical point. Gray market generally means sources operating in a kind of legal gray area, often without proper oversight, maybe labeled research chemicals. Dark gray market is even more overtly unregulated and risky, and the danger is real. We've seen issues with contaminants like lipopolysaccharide or LPS. It's a bacterial endotoxin.
LPS, what does that do?
It can cause severe inflammatory responses, fever, chills, even anaphylactic shock in some cases. It's dangerous stuff if it's not pure. And this ties into the FDA's actions. In October 2023, they placed many peptides, including BPC-157, on what's called a Category 2 list. That effectively banned compounding pharmacies from making them.
So the regulated pharmacies can't make it anymore.
Correct. And it's crucial people understand these compounding pharmacies are highly regulated. They're very different from those research-only companies you might find online where quality control can be, well, questionable at best.
Okay, so if BPC-157 is off the table from compounding pharmacies, are there alternatives people are using?
Yes, there is an alternative emerging. Pentadeca arginate, or PDA. It has a similar molecular structure to BPC-157. We're using it now at doses of 250 to 500 micrograms injected daily, usually Monday through Friday, take the weekends off. And so far, we've had no reported side effects, and it seems to deliver pretty similar benefits in terms of healing and inflammation.
PDA, okay. Good to know there's an option.
Right. For an immediate spark for injuries, we also historically used intravenous BPC, but PDA seems to be the viable alternative now.
Got it. So moving beyond these specific peptides, another big area is direct hormone modulation. We see testosterone therapies getting really popular for both men and women, but you often prefer using peptides instead of direct hormone manipulation, right? What's the thinking there?
Yeah, that's generally true. What's really compelling about peptides, as we touched on, is they offer benefits without typically shutting down your own natural production.
Mm.
Unlike direct hormone therapies, like, say, testosterone pellets, those can lead to really unnatural high concentrations and suppress your body's own output.
Right, the shutdown effect.
Exactly. If we do use direct hormones, we prefer approaches like injections, maybe topical creams or sublingual options, because they allow for more natural variation, peaks and troughs. But the peptide approach specifically tries to avoid that negative feedback loop that can shut down your natural production altogether.
Which brings us back to the sourcing issue,
yes.
Especially with hormones like testosterone. You mentioned the risks of getting it outside a doctor's care.
Oh, the risks are severe. I recall a case, a young guy, 25 years old, after years of testosterone and growth hormone abuse obtained outside any medical guidance, he came in for fertility testing. He had literally zero sperm left. Zero. He was completely infertile.
Wow. That's devastating.
It is. And it just highlights the absolute necessity of physician guidance, particularly when things like fertility or any sensitive physiological system are involved. Just can't mess around with this stuff on your own.
That's a really stark reminder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sticking with growth-related compounds then, let's dive into growth hormone secretagogues. These are peptides that, as you said, stimulate the release of your own endogenous growth hormone, not adding external GH. What are the different flavors here? How do they differ?
Right, secretagogues. They tell your pituitary gland to release more GH. First, there's epimorelin, which I often call epimorelin. It's widely considered the sort of cleanest and most specific for the growth hormone receptor itself. It produces a gentler, more natural burst of growth hormone.
Gentler, okay.
Yeah. We usually recommend a dosage of 100 micrograms or less taken right before sleep, ideally without having eaten carbs in the previous, say, 45 minutes to maximize its effect.
And benefits.
Benefits typically include leaning out, better sleep quality, and really no significant side effects reported. It's very well tolerated.
Okay. Epimorelin sounds pretty clean. What else?
Then, in contrast, you have GHRP6. This one's a bit different. It can stimulate appetite quite significantly.
Ah, the hunger peptide.
Exactly. And it can also stimulate prolactin and ACTH, which means it can elevate cortisol levels. So it's typically used for individuals looking to gain significant muscle mass and strength, especially if they combine it with enough protein, because that appetite stimulation helps them eat more.
Got it. So GHRP6 for bulking, maybe?
Potentially, yeah. Then you have sermorelin and tesamorelin. These work a bit higher up in the chain, signaling the release of GHRH, growth hormone releasing hormone.
Okay, further up the cascade.
Right. Tesamorelin is interesting because it's actually FDA approved specifically for visceral fat reduction. That's the dangerous fat around your organs.
Visceral fat.
Particularly in HIV patients who have lipodystrophy, which is a condition involving abnormal fat distribution. Our observation in practice is it seems to work a bit better in females, generally. And it contributes to better sleep, skin quality, resilience, just overall durability. Typical dose is around 2 milligrams.
2 milligrams for tesamorelin and sermorelin.
Sermorelin has a much broader dosing range, anywhere from 200 up to maybe 3,000 micrograms. It's more general purpose in that GHRH category.
Okay. Any others in this group?
Yeah, a couple more worth mentioning. Hexerelin is one I think of as an energy endurance growth hormone releasing peptide. It's great for morning use. It provides a kind of clean, non-jittery energy burst without spiking appetite like GHRP6 does. Dosage is usually around 100 micrograms.
Morning energy, interesting.
And then there's MK677. This one's actually an oral compound, not an injectable peptide. But it acts similarly to GHRP6. It stimulates appetite, cortisol, and prolactin. So again, not for everyone, but it can be useful for older individuals maybe struggling to put on or maintain muscle mass.
You mentioned you tried it once.
Ha, yeah. I made the mistake of taking it before bed once, woke up absolutely ravenous in the middle of the night. Definitely learn not to do that again.
Lesson learned.
And MK677 was also recently banned by the FDA for compounding. So that one's off the table now, too, from those sources.
Okay, lots of options there. You mentioned stacking peptides earlier. What's the idea behind that?
Right, stacking. The real power often comes from combining different peptides. You can get enhanced synergistic effects, often using lower dosages of each individual one.
Synergy.
For example, we used to have a fantastic fat loss peptide stack. It included BPC-157, epimorelin, and tesamorelin. So in one single shot, you got subcutaneous fat reduction from the epimorelin, visceral fat reduction from the tesamorelin, upregulated growth hormone receptors from the BPC, plus the better sleep and durability.
Wow, that sounds like a powerhouse combo.
It really was transformative for many patients. Compounding pharmacies allowed us to put those together.
And the dosing schedule, 5 days on, 2 days off, Why that pattern?
Yeah, that's pretty common. It's derived largely from traditional growth hormone dosing cycles used with synthetic GH. The idea is to help prevent desensitization, where the receptors might become less responsive over time with continuous stimulation. It also gives the body a necessary break, maybe mimicking a more natural pulsatile release pattern.
Makes sense. Prevent tolerance buildup. Okay, beyond peptides and hormones, what other compounds do you see as really impactful for optimizing health? I know you're not someone who pushes endless supplements, but you seem to have a few key ones you focus on.
I certainly do. I'm not a fan of the kitchen sink approach, but coenzyme Q10 or CoQ10 is definitely foundational for me. It's absolutely key for mitochondrial function, cellular energy production, ATP synthesis.
Mitochondria, the powerhouses.
Exactly. I usually recommend around 200 milligrams daily, though it's technically safe up to much higher doses, like 2400 milligrams. And anecdotally, for me personally, it's been dramatic in virtually eliminating migraine headaches I used to get. It's a real powerhouse for cellular energy.
Well, eliminating migraines is huge. Okay, CoQ10.
Yeah.
You've also mentioned methylated B vitamins before. That's becoming a more common topic. What's the story with genetic variations like MTHFR, those SNPs you hear about? And how do these specific B vitamins help?
Right, MTHFR. A SNP is just a single nucleotide polymorphism. It's basically a common genetic variation where certain metabolic processes, like methylation in this case, maybe don't run quite as efficiently as they theoretically could.
Okay, a slight difference in the gene.
Yeah, very common. The MTHFR SNP specifically impacts methylation pathways, and we often see its impact reflected in homocysteine levels. Homocysteine is a significant cardiovascular risk marker. If your levels are elevated, typically we look for levels above 7 or maybe 9, depending on the lab's range, you're considered at an increased risk of a cardiovascular event, like heart attack or stroke.
Okay, so high homocysteine is bad news.
Definitely something to address. Methylated B vitamins, things like methyl B12, methylfolate, also compounds like trimethylglycine, TMG, or methionine, act as methylation donors. They essentially help push those methylation pathways along, improving efficiency and helping to lower homocysteine levels.
So they help overcome that genetic bottleneck, so to speak.
That's a good way to put it. Most people, honestly, whether they know they have an MTHFR SNP or not, could probably benefit from taking a methylated B complex to support optimal methylation. I like taking them in the morning for sustained energy, but some people find they're really useful as a pick-me-up for that, 3 p.m. slump, too.
Mm. Okay, methylated Ds for methylation support. Now, I have to ask about pineal gland for sleep. I've heard some really remarkable things. In fact, I had the chance to try it myself combined with glycine. And what I personally saw was a truly dramatic increase in my REM sleep, like going from maybe an hour and a half on a good night to nearly 3 hours consistently, which for me felt profound. Can you explain the science? Why does pineolone seem to have such a big effect?
Yeah, your response to pineolone is exactly what we see pretty consistently in the clinic. It's fascinating. It's one of the smallest peptides we use, just a few amino acids, but the effect can be quite profound. It's thought to work by stimulating the pinealocytes, those are the cells in your pineal gland, to produce melatonin more effectively.
Stimulating your own melatonin production.
Right. And there's even some data, mostly preclinical, suggesting it might help with pineal gland regeneration over time. Now, if it truly helps with pineal gland regeneration, it makes sense that it could improve sleep even on the nights when you're not taking it, right? Because the gland itself is functioning better.
That would explain the lasting effect.
Exactly. And the importance of REM sleep, as you experience, just can't be overstated. It's critical for neuroplasticity, for memory consolidation, healthy emotional processing. It has a huge impact on mental health. And importantly, we've observed essentially no side effects with pineolone, which is a stark contrast to some FDA-approved sleep drugs like, say, Doris, which for some patients were just a total disaster due to side effects, grogginess, and the cost.
Right. So pineolone seems very targeted and clean. You mentioned combining it with glycine.
Yes. I typically combine pineolone with glycine. Glycine is an amino acid, but it also functions as an inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. It helps calm the nervous system, which obviously facilitates falling asleep and staying asleep.
Mm, calm. Okay. How much glycine?
I usually recommend starting with maybe 3 to 5 grams orally, right at bedtime. You can gradually increase it up to maybe 10 grams if needed. And glycine has a nice additional benefit too. It plays a role in phase 2 liver detoxification pathways. So it helps your body clear out toxins, which is crucial for overall
and
health.
Detox support too, interesting.
But this brings up that critical point again. sourcing. It is absolutely necessary to get Pinealon and really any peptide from a trusted physician and a legitimate compounding pharmacy. There is so much, frankly, BS stuff online claiming to be peptides. Sometimes it contains melatonin instead, sometimes other random substances, sometimes nothing at all, or worse, contaminants.
Yeah, the Wild West online.
Exactly. It's a big concern for both efficacy, will it even work, and safety. You have to know what you're getting.
Absolutely crucial. Okay, let's talk about NAD. You've called this the most impactful agent you have observed over years of practice. You even use the word transformational.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is NAD, and what kind of transformations are we really talking about here?
That's right. NAD, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And yes, transformational is the word I keep coming back to. It truly can be. It's a fundamental coenzyme found in all living cells. It's absolutely vital for hundreds of metabolic processes, especially energy production in the mitochondria.
Coenzyme, okay. How do you typically administer it?
The most powerful effects we see are with intravenous or IV administration. Our recommended loading dose protocol now is usually 750 milligrams infused over 1 to 2 hours. This is quite different from the old protocols from the 1990s used for addiction treatment, which might have been 3,000 milligrams over 6, 8, even 10 hours. Much more intense.
Right, faster infusion now.
Yeah, seems to be better tolerated and still highly effective. We typically suggest a loading phase, maybe 5 treatments over 10 days, something like that, to really saturate the system.
And the benefits, what do people report?
The observed benefits are remarkably uniform. I'd say about 95% of patients report similar things. They often describe feeling like their brain is getting bigger, like it's expanding.
Bigger, how so?
More creative, sharper focus, an elevated mood, often needing less sleep, but having more sustained energy throughout the day. Some people even say colors look brighter, or that languaging feels easier, more fluent.
Wow, that's profound.
It really is. It truly seems to affect the nervous system first and most dramatically, with physical benefits often following. For maintenance, after the loading dose, a once-a-month infusion is often recommended to keep levels topped up.
Sounds amazing, but I imagine it's not cheap.
It's definitely an investment. I must acknowledge the cost. It can range anywhere from, say, $500 to $1,000 or even more per infusion, depending on the clinic and location.
Okay. Is there a more accessible option?
There is a subcutaneous option, injecting it under the skin. Typically 100 milligrams, maybe 5 days on, 2 days off. It's an alternative, though some people do experience stomach cramping with the subcutaneous route. Not everyone, but it can happen.
Right. You mentioned a personal experience with NAD and COVID.
I did, yeah. During a bout of COVID, I felt pretty rough. Took a home test, had a really strong positive ban. I went and got an NAD IV infusion. Within 24 hours, I tested again. Absolutely no band. Completely negative. And my symptoms were drastically reduced. It was remarkable.
From strong positive to negative in 24 hours.
Exactly. And another quick story. A patient with severe chronic Epstein-Barr virus. She was actually on disability because of the fatigue and brain fog. We did the NAD loading dose protocol. And within a week, she called me and said, I'm back. Like her old self was back. It was incredible.
Those are powerful anecdotes. What's the mechanism? Is it just fueling mitochondria?
Well, that's the standard explanation, right? NAD fuels mitochondrial function, drives ATP production.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, the profound symptomatic changes we see, especially in the brain, it makes me think there's got to be something else going on, something outside the direct mitochondrial effect of NAD that's maybe not fully understood yet by science. It feels bigger than just ATP.
More to uncover there. What about precursors like NMN or NR? Do they compare?
Yeah, NMN, nicotinamide mononucleotide, and NR, nicotinamide riboside, are precursors. NMN, often taken sublingually, seems to make hair and nails grow faster for many people. NR, usually taken orally, has some literature suggesting it might reduce inflammation markers in humans. They likely help boost NAD levels to some degree. But in my clinical experience, the direct NAD infusions have consistently shown the most impactful and rapid results. The precursors seem more subtle, maybe better for long-term maintenance for some.
Got it. 5-E NAD for the big impact. Okay, let's switch gears slightly to methylene blue. You called it an ancient cognitive booster that's making a comeback. I remember using it years ago to clean fish tanks. Does it actually, like, turn your tongue blue? And how does it work for cognition?
Huh, yes, the fish tank cleaner. And it absolutely can turn your time, and definitely your urine, a distinct blue or green color for about 24 hours. So don't be alarmed.
Good to know.
Methylene blue was actually, believe it or not, the very first synthetic pharmaceutical ever prescribed in this country, way back in the late 1800s.
Huh?
Mostly as an antiseptic and for malaria.
First pharmaceutical.
Wow. Yeah, so while it sounds new and cutting edge, because it's regaining favor, it has a very long history. It's popular now because of its profound role in mitochondrial function. It specifically interacts with cytochrome C oxidase, a key enzyme in the electron transport chain where oxygen is used to make ATP.
Okay, helping mitochondria use oxygen.
Exactly. I often think of it as an oxygenator. It can actually displace carbon monoxide from red blood cells, which is why it's still used as an antidote in carbon monoxide poisoning cases.
Fascinating. How is it typically taken?
Unlike NAD, it actually has excellent oral absorption. Typical dosages for cognitive benefits are relatively low, usually no more than 10 milligrams taken in the morning. It acts as a cognitive stimulant.
10 milligrams, okay.
And interestingly, if it doesn't turn your urine green or blue after taking it, that might actually suggest your mitochondria are under significant stress and are soaking up all of it, with none left over to be excreted. It can be an indicator.
That's a built-in bioindicator. What benefits do people notice?
Primarily cognitive enhancement things like improved recall, better memory, sharper focus. And it also has known antiviral properties as well. It can sometimes be compounded with other agents like maybe caffeine or B vitamins for an enhanced brain function stack.
How often would someone take it?
It's probably not an everyday thing for most. Maybe about 3 times a week seems reasonable for cognitive support.
And sourcing, same concerns as peptides.
Absolutely. Be very cautious about over-the-counter sources, like those lab-grade powders online. Purity is absolutely not guaranteed and can vary wildly. Definitely best obtained from a trusted compounding pharmacy via a physician.
Right. Quality control is key. This whole discussion really brings us to an inescapable reality in this field. Regulation. The FDA's actions. Let's pull back the curtain a bit. Why does it seem like the FDA is bringing down the hammer on so many of these compounds we've discussed? What's your perspective on why peptides are being banned?
Yeah, it's a really complex and, frankly, contentious issue. There are definitely two significant sides to this coin. Besides BPC-157 and MK-677, other really useful peptides recently removed from the compounding market by the FDA include thymosin alpha-1. That was excellent for immune modulation, autoimmune disease, even helpful for long COVID folks. We used it often very safely, but now it's off the table for compounding.
Thymosin alpha-1, okay. Others?
Thyhexa, which is a potent BDNF boost. Remember, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, like fertilizer for brain cells? That's gone. And cerebrolacin, derived from pig brains, used often in Europe for post-stroke and TBI recovery. That's also been restricted, though it did have a potential side effect of causing temporary mood shifts to a kind of dark place for some individuals. It needed careful monitoring.
So why the bans? What are the two sides you mentioned?
Well, the FDA's stated stance, which is side one, is usually centered around safety concerns and a desire to understand this better through more extensive, large-scale, traditional clinical trials, you know, the standard pharmaceutical pathway.
Okay, the official safety and research reason.
Right. But then there's side two, which, from my perspective and many others in this field, involves the influence of pharmaceutical companies. They see these effective peptides readily available, relatively affordably, to the commoner through compounding pharmacies. And the thinking is they want to potentially take these compounds, tweak them slightly, patent them, and turn them into blockbuster patented drugs.
Ah, the patent and profit motive.
Exactly. Look at Vyleesi for female sexual dysfunction. It's essentially a derivative of PT-141, another peptide that was available through compounding. Now it's a patented, expensive drug. So my personal conclusion, it's probably both motivations at play. There might be legitimate questions needing more research for some compounds, but there's also undoubtedly a financial and market control aspect. It really highlights how government regulation, while obviously necessary for safety, can sometimes, in my opinion, go too far and end up limiting access to potentially beneficial therapies, especially those that can't be easily patented.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? Safety versus access and innovation.
It really is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it raises important questions about the state of modern medicine overall. I mean, let's be frank. Conventional medicine, despite spending astronomical amounts of money, is struggling significantly with the major chronic diseases of our time. Heart disease, cancer, autoimmune conditions, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, we're not winning those battles convincingly.
That's a sobering thought.
And there's still this historical paternalistic model sometimes where the doctor knows best. But studies have shown that over 30% of prescriptions written are effectively run away by patients they never even fill them.
30%? Wow. Why?
Lack of trust, cost, side effect concerns, feeling unheard, probably a mix of all of those. There's often a disconnect between the prescription pad and the patient's reality or willingness to comply.
So how do you bridge that gap?
My focus personally has shifted dramatically over the years. It's about helping people feel better first, Build trust. Give them some quick wins. Empower them to take agency in their own health journey. Because ultimately, health is a deeply personal responsibility. No pill, no potion, no injection can replace good behaviors, proper diet, consistent exercise, stress management, good sleep.
Foundations.
Absolutely. Pills are fantastic, life-saving for acute life and death situations. Like I mentioned, I had a blood clot years ago that likely would have killed me without pharmaceutical intervention. I'm forever grateful for that drug.
Right. Critical interventions.
Absolutely critical. But those same kinds of medicines often aren't the things that are going to help me or you lead our best, most vibrant, optimized life on a daily basis. They manage disease. They don't necessarily build optimal health. And historically, you can look back at things like the Flexner Report in the early 20th century. It was a major turning point that really shifted medical education heavily towards a pharmaceutical model and largely sidelined or discredited alternative modalities like chiropractic, acupuncture, nutrition science. At the time.
Interesting historical context.
Yeah. And the reality of the market today is that these gray market or black market options for peptides and other things exist precisely because people are seeking results. They're looking for solutions that the conventional system maybe isn't providing or isn't equipped to address effectively or quickly enough.
People are searching for what works.
Exactly. And sometimes that leads them down risky paths if they don't have proper guidance. Which brings me to something beyond all the biochemistry, beyond the peptides and NAD. The profound, yet often less discussed, impact of just our thoughts. Positive thinking. Mindset.
The mind-body connection.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that adopting a more positive outlook, focusing on solutions and gratitude, can genuinely influence our physiology and well-being. It can influence others, too. Plant seeds for positive change, create a ripple effect. It's part of why I made a personal decision way back in 2010 to stop taking insurance in my practice. It wasn't primarily about money, it was about time.
Time.
Time to have deeper, more valuable conversations with patients. Time to go beyond just writing a prescription every 7 minutes, which is often the reality in the insurance-based system. Time to actually talk about lifestyle, mindset, purpose. In this context, things like peptides and NAD, they can almost act as gateways.
The gateways how?
They help build trust because people often feel better relatively quickly. They experience tangible benefits. And when they feel better physically and mentally, they gain the energy, the clarity, the motivation to start exploring those deeper aspects of health. They get the bandwidth to find their unique purpose, whatever that may be, and to, you know, shine their light in the world. Feeling good physically is often the first step towards that bigger picture.
That's a really inspiring way to look at it. Using these tools not just for symptoms, but as a springboard to greater well-being and purpose. Expert, this deep dive has truly unveiled just an incredible array of tools available now in this world of peptides, NAD, other compounds, tools that could potentially have a profound impact on our health and performance. The crucial takeaway, though, as we've hit on again and again throughout our conversation, is the absolute paramount importance of responsible sourcing and always, always working with knowledgeable, ideally board-certified physicians who understand this complex landscape. So what does this all mean for you listening? Well, while modern medicine certainly provides critical, often life-saving intervention, the ultimate pursuit of your peak health, your vitality, your purpose, that's really an individual journey. It requires agency, taking ownership, it requires continuous learning, staying curious, and perhaps most importantly, a commitment to exploring what truly works for you personally, even if, maybe especially if, it challenges conventional wisdom sometimes.